Do not blow on the mics. Do not blow into the mics. Might as well get going. Ladies and gentlemen, if we may begin. Another on-time press conference. Billy? Jim Lovell is running a little bit late on his physical. He's all right, but he's in the last stages of it, which is going to take him about another 15 or 20 minutes, and then he'll be with us. But we thought we might as well go ahead as soon as Bill Anders shows. What'd you do with him, Frank? Hey, he walked over with us. The crew has some film they want to show this morning, and any other remarks they may care to make. That's all we know about. I just want to warn the cameraman that we are going to lose the house lights, but you may already have been given the film strip. So without further ado, let's get Bill Anders up there and get started.
Still? You gonna be late for launch too? Come on.
He's the clumsy one, you know.
You want to show the? Should we show the movie first?
Yeah, let's do that first. Okay.
I realize we're going to Gemini.
We have some training shots or shots. Movie cover films that were taken during our training. We thought perhaps we'd give you a rundown of what we've been doing the past 3 or 4 months by showing about 10 minutes worth of film.
It'll be on your left, Frank.
We may have to move for this, I don't know. Oh no, there it is. This shows you the training we were doing in the boilerplate egress training. Before we go out in the Gulf, we practice over here in a building. We get all the procedures down properly before we get out in the Gulf. I think we ought to keep this informal, and if y'all have any questions as we go along, please just ask them and we'll...
See, that's a large tank in building 4, I believe, isn't it?
No, building it's 5. Over there in the... that high bay building down by the south gate, Paul. I don't know what the number of it. This is the position, of course, that the 7 crew ended up in stable 2. As you can see, we were doing this before they flew, so all the crews have practiced this. Here we are coming out underwater. That's Jim. Gee, these are good shots. I haven't seen that one yet either. Hopefully, we'll never have to use this form of egressing from the spacecraft. You get quite a bit. As a matter of fact, that's one of the problems. As you try to go down in the water, the suit tries to push you back up. So it's a hindrance rather than a help. Is that you, Bill?
No, that's still Jim.
Jim opening the life raft. I don't know why he's treading water. He has a Mae West on.
He's running away from the sharks.
There's our 3-man raft. It's about big enough for 2 men. This must be Anders. Actually, this was only training, and if we have a real egress like this, the commander goes out first.
Frank's telling Jim and I to get out of the raft.
You can see what I mean. It's a kind of a small. I'd hate like to spend much time in that in the ocean, but I guess it would suffice. There we are. Of course, the normal situation would be to stay in the spacecraft. The only reason that we'd ever egress is if we had a leaky spacecraft. Here, this is the shot of a briefing that was run in our library. That's Neil Armstrong, who's on our backup crew. Actually, we're going over systems here with the people, the instructors from, I think it was from AC Spark Plug, weren't they? The people that make the guidance and navigation equipment. That's really Jim's address book. He just, that's Buzz Aldrin, our backup command module pilot. And the third member of our backup team is Fred Hayes. As you're probably aware, we had some of you may not be aware, some of you from overseas, we had a change in the crew when Mike Collins, who was originally on our crew, had spinal surgery. And Jim Lovell took his place, and then we revamp the backup crew. This is training on the slide wire down at Cape Kennedy. We have an emergency egress capability from the top of the gantry. In the event of an emergency, we can use these collars and come sailing off the 320-foot level of the gantry. Of course, this is just a small training rig here. They've had a considerable amount of trouble with engineering this thing correctly, and it's finally just coming around.
Well, Jim.
For the size of his seat, I think it's level. It is. Jim Lovell. Bill. That would be quite a ride from the 320-foot level, but we didn't practice that one. This shows the actual egress training that we did on the Gulf. You see, we started in the stable 2 position, and this shows you the spacecraft rolling over exactly the same way they did on 7. Jim Lovell, who did most of our egress work and the qualification of the equipment, claims that this is a far better boat than Gemini, but I didn't find it to be that way. I was very glad to get out again. Very nice. I thought, did you like that one, Bill?
Okay. I thought it was a superior way to go up to the helicopter.
On our mission now, we'll be landing about 45 minutes to an hour before sunrise. So we will, unless we have some difficulty, we'll probably just stay in the cap in the spacecraft for an hour until first light, and then egress. Well, this is the training we did at the centrifuge. As you know, we'll be running a high speed and a higher G reentry than we have in the past. And so we did some simulation on the centrifuge to prove to ourselves that we'd have no trouble with it, and of course we didn't have any. The centrifuge that you see here is located right over by Building 7 here on the center. I believe it's the finest centrifuge if you can call a centrifuge fine, it's the best there is in the country. It's a very good training device. The maximum plus G we took on one of the spikes approached 9 Gs. Of course, we've ridden much higher than that, but a nominal entry from supercircular velocities will only result in a G load of maximum G pulse on the order of 6 to 7 Gs, depending, of course, on our entry angle. One of the troubles with simulating G fields in a centrifuge is that you get the rotary motion that tends to spin your gyros, as we say, or cause your inner ear to get rotating, and you're a little wobbly sometimes when you climb out of one. This shows us in our training at the simulator located at Cape Kennedy. Ordinarily, we don't wear suits when we train in the simulator, but we did want to try the launch through TLI in a suited configuration. We have an average of over 200 hours per person in the simulator already, and we had another 100 hours scheduled before the launch, but I think we'll probably taper off a little bit on that now. One of our instructors, one of the many people that contribute to the success of these missions.
Jim is in the shower, so he'll be here in 5 minutes.
I apologize for Jim being late this morning, but we had a little tie-up on one of our apparatuses over there, and so he had to... He was last in line.
Shall we go to questions before he gets here?
Oh, I think we might as well go ahead, and then we ask us questions about him until he gets here. And then...
Ed? Are we up here? Ed Nalong.
Frank, you said you're going to taper off on the simulations from now until flight. Right here.
Oh, okay.
You said you're going to taper off from now on simulations from now until the flight. Does this indicate that you think you're pretty well up on getting ready for it? And
yes,
how much will you taper off?
I think we're in pretty good shape. We'll be spending a great deal of time in the last 2 weeks reviewing our checklist and reflying specific points of the flight, but I don't think there'll be any long... I hope we're over the peak of training. I've always tried in the past to be ready to fly a month before a launch. We didn't make that this time, but I think we could say we're ready 2 weeks before.
On returning to Earth, I believe the spacecraft must hit a very narrow window in the Earth's atmosphere, and that this has never been attempted by the United States from a lunar trajectory. It's never been attempted by the Russians with a man inside. Therefore, it seems that to some that it's the most hazardous aspect of the whole expedition. Would one of you care to comment, please, on one, the risk involved in hitting that very small window, and two, the steps taken to get it right?
Yes, you're touching on a point that I think is a great concern to most of the people. Actually, the entry portion of the flight is probably the least concern to me. You say that we haven't done it from the return from the lunar trajectory, and that's true. But we did have two Saturn V shots, which went out several thousand miles and then fired the spacecraft back into the atmosphere at velocities higher than one of them was higher than we will be re-entering. Now, the only concern then is whether you can hit the corridor. And this, in all reality, is the basis of the ground capability, the ground radar, the ground tracking. This has been tested, proved, retested. We've run correlations with lunar orbiter data. And I feel certain that we'll have no trouble navigating correctly to the corridor. Now, as I said before, in the centrifuge, we've practiced flying these entries with nothing but a G-meter. And we found with a G-meter and an attitude reference, we can successfully enter from lunar trajectories. So I'll be very happy to get to that portion of the flight. I won't feel that it's all over then, but at least I'll have been assured that, in my opinion, the greatest hazards are behind us. Bill, how do you feel about that?
Bill Cronenberg.
Frank, JPL reported sunspots on the sun, and it looked like they might flare up. If they do flare up, would they delay your flight or give you a problem while you're around the moon?
One of the things we've done on this flight is kind of specialized. I'm kind of the entry specialist. Bill and Jim are operating around the moon, and Bill is our radiation expert, so I'd like to defer that question to Bill.
Well, the control center does have a plan that takes into account sunspot prediction capability and solar flare measurement activity. And there are levels of which they would hold a mission if a solar flare of a serious nature was expected or actually had occurred. But these have to be a pretty big flare to slow us down too much. Just like the weather, maybe a little less.
Would this bother us even if we're inside the command module, Bill?
No, it takes a very unusual flare. They probably haven't seen more than one or two in the last decade or two that would really be of any noticeable consequence inside the vehicle. I'm sorry, can't hear you. No, all you can predict is an area of activity, and where the giant flare might come has not been very well correlated.
What do you do if one of these giant flares comes
well,
while you're...
As Frank pointed out, the command module is a very thick vehicle, and we really don't have a great concern for solar flares, and if one that we either hadn't seen, of a magnitude we hadn't seen before, or one, a very unusual one might occur, we could possibly alter the mission, or stay in orbit around the moon and take its one-half shielding effect in order to reduce the radiation dose. We think that this the radiation is something you can't ignore, but it's nothing of a real limiting nature for the command module.
Jules, down front here. Why don't you stand there?
Frank, how do you weigh the risks of the spacecraft engine failing and getting stuck in orbit around the moon as against the value and return from the mission? And in your own mind and Bill's, what do you think those risks are?
Well, I think this...
I think this mission is an extremely important one, and I think that we've engineered the possibility of failure to escape from lunar orbit to an acceptable level. As you know, the service module engine has been tested, I guess, more than any of the other components on the vehicle. And when you look at the overall mission, you come away with the realization that as any of these missions go, any of the lunar missions go, it's a conservative mission. Now, I don't believe in the trite saying that, you're accepting more risk by driving on a freeway or something like that. As far as I'm concerned, that's nonsense. But the business is risky, and I think we've accepted a minimal amount of unknowns on this flight. And it's one of the nice things about it. We've taken, and instead of having one huge giant step with a lunar mission with a limb on and a rendezvous and everything else, we've broken it down into a more acceptable pattern.
Is there a risk equation you, Bill, and Jim have? I mean, do you equate this in your own mind to being less or more than a freeway, less or more than flying a T-38 or F-4 or whatever?
Oh, I equate it to much more than that. I look at it as something like a combat tour in Vietnam, the risk involved. How do you feel about that?
That's what well put. I think that what risk we take is certainly well compensated by the gain that the program will get from this mission.
What size variations in the lunar orbit are you expecting from the mass concentrations that have been found on the moon?
I guess the data they had from the lunar orbiter program indicated there were some perturbations in the lunar orbit, but they were pretty small. So the kind of thing you'd like to get a handle on prior to the time you'd try to land a limb on the moon. And it does, knowing what perturbations you might get in your flight path, certainly will decrease your landing gear ellipse.
Do you have any handle on the amount of difference in your particular orbit you might expect in miles?
That's one of the reasons we're flying the mission, is to find out how much the orbit will be affected by these mass concentrations on the moon. And we hope that the tracking data will give us information, not necessarily, not to tie down the lunar potential, but at least to enable the ground to predict what the LEM will do and what the command module will do in a trajectory that they'll be flying, which is very similar to the one we'll be flying.
It's certainly less than a half a mile, or probably even less than that.
Professor Bernard Lavoie has described the flight, the manned aspect of it, as being unnecessary and silly. This is a view that seems to be held by quite a few scientists. Would you please comment on that?
Yes, we saw the article that was supposedly written, or at least the result of an interview with Sir Bernard Lovell, and then on the 12th page, as is so often the case, in the newspaper 3 days later, He came out and said he'd been misquoted, and he really didn't believe that. He thought it would be a great journey and I think he said a great adventure. And he was certain that this country would not undertake it if the risks were prohibitive. I think that he may have been the victim of some sensational journalism. I'm sure they don't have those in England, but we have some of them over here. I have the highest regard for him, and I hope he has his telescope or his radio dishes beamed on us. He's done a great job of tracking in the past.
Frank, that gentleman represents the London Times, which is not a sensational paper.
Oh, yeah.
I'll assure you of that. The Sunday Times, yes.
Frank, along with your professional interest in what you see on the moon, you probably have some personal curiosity. What are some of the things you're looking forward to see when you get close to the moon?
Again, I'd like to refer that to Bill. He's been studying the moon far more than I have, and he has spent many long hours in the evening going over targets of opportunity and things that the scientists and so on have asked him to look for.
Well, you know, the argument has raged for years over whether the holes in the moon are meteoritic impact or volcanic. And certainly there's a lot of evidence for both. Some of the craters are obviously one or the other, but there are a lot of in-betweens, and as soon as you become convinced that one particular crater is a meteor impact, why, some guy can show some evidence where it might be a volcano, and the argument goes back and forth, and I think it'll be very interesting to get a very close hand view of the moon and to be able to not just see a single picture from any particular sun angle of one particular place, but to be able to integrate the whole lunar scene and have a feel for really what has gone on and try to get an idea of the history of the lunar surface by observing it close range.
Frank, Bill, I wonder if we could talk a little about your plans for the onboard television, since that's the link that all of us will have with you. Who, for example, will be the cameraman? What are your plans as far as trying to look out the window? We're tucked over here behind all those photographers.
I see. Well, we have plans for two on the way, two there, and two on the way back. And we've jokingly said that, what was it? Jim was the director, and you were the cameraman, and I was the producer. We don't have any actors yet, so I think most of our... I hope that we can get some significant out-the-window views, because we should not have the problem of the orbital rate that kind of plagued the seven out-the-window views. I hope we can get some good views of the Earth from the moon and of the moon on trans-Earth. Other than that, I'm not certain. I guess we'd have to confine it to the indoor activities, and we've already been way outdone on anything we could hope to do on that, since I don't want to compete.
I think we'll be competing with Lowell Thomas rather than Bob Hope.
Now, don't say I said that, because
Jim Lovell said it. I heard him. In the middle here.
I wonder if we could go back to the safety aspect of the flight, which seems to be marked strongly throughout by redundancy and backup systems and equipment. One area where this doesn't seem to occur, apart from the thrust chamber on the SPS, is in the lack of provision of an unmanned backup rescue vehicle. Would you care to comment on the fact that this aspect is missing?
Yes, sir. This problem was raised during the Gemini flights also. And as a matter of fact, it became almost a political issue in this country of whether we should have a standby rescue capability. And in all candor, I don't believe the country at this time has the resources to provide a backup rescue vehicle. We're taxing Cape Kennedy to the utmost now, counting down the one vehicle and preparing the others. And I don't believe that the physical capability exists to provide an unmanned backup
course, we don't even have an unmanned vehicle that could do it. But let's say you could launch an Apollo with one man in it. I think that the technical complexity, the risk to the rescue vehicle and trying to run it with one man, the economic factor involved makes this totally unacceptable and totally prohibitive for the foreseeable future.
Personally, for every dollar they spend on a rescue vehicle, I'd just be happy if they'd spend 50 cents to make making the Apollo just that redundant. I think that's where your best investment is, in the vehicle you're in.
It would seem almost from your reply that from the economic point of view, half of not putting the thing up is made up for by the fact that you will be able to pass very important data should something go wrong on that trans-Earth injection. Would you get a comment on what your actions would be after that, should this occur?
After the failure of it to light, I think that'd be a real-time decision. I don't know how you'd want to spend your last days, Bill, but I haven't even thought about it. Yes, sir. Sure would. My hair, I'll pour it. Black, yeah. I really, that's one area we haven't even considered.
Thanks.
I'm sorry we're missing Jim. He's going to really be mad about this. He's kind of, well. Yes, sir.
Rescue obviously is academic on your mission. From the points of view you make, the backup of hardware at the Cape, the unavailability of a vehicle, and all that type of thing. But as we come down the road to the first landing flight, what do you fellows think about the possibility, for example, of landing an unmanned limb on 2P2 or 2P8, whatever the first site is that's picked, an unmanned limb that might have extra O2, food, etc., in case the manned limb could not get off?
Jules, my personal opinion, and you know, it's one of the nice things that I keep telling everybody, and maybe with some foreign visitors here, we ought to reiterate it. One of the beautiful things about being in this program is that what we're saying is really our own opinion, and the candor that we express here is genuine. And my opinion is that there'll never be an acceptable backup hardware rescue capability for the Apollo lunar landing program. Because I don't think it's feasible.
Even if it was feasible to get a limb, unmanned limb on lunar surface, the accuracies of landing right next to it, I think you'd never be able
Jules,
to get close
to it. Jules, if you landed 2 miles away from where the man limb, just try to walk 2 miles in a pressure suit.
But
carrying
a plus. Walk a half a mile.
The inverse proportion, Frank. The idea is to land the unmanned limb first and then have the manned vehicle, because your flight and 10 have removed many of the dispersions and anomalies, have your flight land next to it.
Well, Jules, you run into problems, for instance, then if you've got hypergolics on board, the compatibility problem. How hot is that thing going to get there on the limb? How are you going to unpower it? How are you going to power it down? The limb is not designed to land unmanned. Now, we could put a programmer in it and maybe land it unmanned.
I don't think it could.
I just don't think it's worth it. What we're trying to do now with a man in it is so terribly complicated that it almost overwhelms me at times. Just getting prepared for this flight, where we don't even have to consider a limb, has been a real chore. Now, when I think about the people that are coming on and they have to worry about a command module, a limb, a rendezvous, a landing, they've got their hands full. And I think what we may have done somewhere along the way here is make it easier for the crews that follow on. They can concentrate on the limb and the rendezvous. Hopefully, when we get back, we can hand them some checklists, flight plan, and say, do it this way, and it'll work perfect. The limb is what you'll have to prove.
Perfectly normal risks, then.
I think they're acceptable risks, Jules, and I think that we have to do this. If we really believe that what we're doing is worthwhile, then we accept the risk. When we get to the point where we don't believe it's worthwhile, I quit.
Right here.
You said earlier in answer to a question of mine that the re-entry was among the least of your problems, that the main hazards you felt would be behind you by then. What would you rate, then, as the most difficult part of the total flight?
The most difficult part of the total flight is going to be spending 6 more days with the gentleman who's just entering the room.
Here he is now. Direct from the Mr. Physical Fitness.
Roger Chamber.
Nice to see you. Glad you're aboard. Sir, I think that the most critical portion of the flight will be one hitting the corridor around the moon. We have a corridor around the moon that we're trying to hit, too, for our lunar orbit insertion. And then, of course, the proper guidance and the proper engine and guidance performance leaving lunar orbit. We have to have that system work. And I know, as I said before, it's tested. Everything has been doubly checked on it, but if that doesn't work, we've had a bad day.
Maybe we're not the busy.
I can't
Wait,
hear you.
Could we hear it for the mic, please?
How'd you make that?
Okay, it was long. Did you 3 minutes?
And how do you regard the launch itself, in view of the fact that Saturn V has not carried manned spacecraft before?
Toward them?
Well, we were. I was involved. I was in the crew safety committee that had a lot to do with engineering emergency equipment, emergency detection equipment on the Saturn V. And if you're aware of the fact, we had future or past plans for flying many of these things unmanned. And we're fully in accord with the decision to fly 2 good unmanned ones and then man the third one. You never get a large enough sample size on this thing to prove that it's safe, that the next one's going to be safe. You could fly 50 of them, and you're not sure that the 51st one wouldn't have some defect that would only be detectable if you flew 1,000 of them.
This will be done on Christmas Day, Frank. How do you feel about doing it on Christmas, and how does your family feel about
I
the
can't
maneuver
see
being?
Who's asking.
Wait a minute. Thank you.
Jim, why don't... How do you feel?
Well, I guess I can speak for all three. I think that...
Now, wait a minute. We didn't say that.
I'll speak for myself. I feel that the task is so important that we do not have any apprehension or any regrets about going during the Christmas time. As a matter of fact, it seems that most of the flights that I've been on, either backup or prime, have been around this particular time. So it's not really a change of pace as far as my family goes.
The religious significance, is there any feeling this is a Christian holy day?
I can't think of a better religious aspect to the flight than to further explore the heavens, as you might say. I feel also that as a Christmas present, I think that it'd be a fairly good one for the country.
It doesn't conflict with my personal religion, if that's a question you're asking. I share Jim. You spoke for me too on that one.
This might be a.
We better ask Bill. He's Catholic. I don't know. But.
I've got a special dispensation. But possibly, being this time of the year, will be a very appropriate time to try to generate among all the peoples of the world. Sort of the feeling that we have in this exploration of space, which we think is a good thing. Christmas is a good thing, and maybe this idea will catch on with others.
I think we're all leaving here with the feeling that was very well expressed the last press conference by a German correspondent, that when you're finally up at the moon looking back at the Earth, it's all these differences and nationalistic traits are going to pretty well blend, and you're going to get a concept that maybe this is really one world, and why the hell can't we learn to live together like decent people? I think this might be an appropriate season to go along with that. This is the feeling that I must admit, it's a predisposer. I feel this way now, and I think we felt that way after we landed from our orbital flights.
Well, we have a particular job to do, and I think our families realize it, and that if we're gone at Christmas time, we'll celebrate at another time.
I've been gone at Christmases before, and quite frankly, I don't like the thought of being gone, and and neither does my family. But again, as Jim said, it's the job we're in. And as Mr. Truman said, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. So it's just the fact that we have to do it.
Frank, Bill. What's on the menu for Christmas dinner in space?
Yeah, Bill Cromie in the middle here.
I don't know. Listen, you're talking to the world's worst gourmet. I don't know what it is. Jim, you're the...
Christmas dinner? I'm not too sure. I suspect it'll probably be turkey bites and, the usual tang and things like this.
Did you request anything special?
We haven't, no. Last time I liked fruitcake on Gemini 7, if you recall, and I made the mistake of mentioning that to the people who provide the food, and we had fruitcake for 14 days. And if they're going to put fruitcake in for this Christmas, I'm sunk.
The only thing we asked on the food was that they take, the 7 crew complained that the drinks were too sweet. They'd added sugar to give more calories in the drinks, and we asked them to take the sugar out of the drinks, and then we eat the GI menu.
Louis?
Frank, you've been talking about the risks on this mission and some of the solemn things like the religious problem or significance. What are some of the fun things you're looking forward to on this flight?
The fun things?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you want the honest truth, as my mother used to say, she wants the honest truth from me when I was a baby. The thing I'm looking forward to most is stepping out on the carrier after a successful mission. I don't know. Now, did I speak for you?
Well, I actually think, though, there are some other, I don't know if you call them fun ideas, but certainly the flight itself is thrilling. And the fact that we'll be able to see the moon at such a close distance with our eyes instead of by a camera, the fact that we can see Earth set and Earth rise, and just to be out there from a personal point of view, I think is really the thrilling part of the flight. I'm looking forward to it.
The greatest sensation I believe I've had in my life, though, was landing in Gemini 7 after completing a successful mission. Now, there were thrilling times, exciting times in flight, but there was nothing that compared with the sense of accomplishment or exhilaration that we had when we got on that carrier. And that, I thought you were asking where would I have the most emotional response, and that would be it for me. Everything that Jim said about the flight, there's no substitute for spaceflight. It's the greatest thing in the world.
No substitute for lunar orbit.
Bill is very anxious to get above 50. We can't abort below 50 miles because Bill wants his gold astronaut pin. So he.
What did you tell him before I got here?
You got a new suit, and then you didn't show up.
Yeah, well, you know how it goes.
Considerable comment has passed about the cramped conditions in what is a space not much bigger than that you'd get in a car. Do weightless conditions change the cramped quality of your living in that capsule very much? Would you comment on that?
Jim?
Well, certainly that's one of the nice advantages of space flight is the fact that in zero G,
hey, come on,
the volume of the spacecraft seems to increase. And the fact that we don't have an up or down. We couldn't, I don't think, last 2 weeks in Gemini 7 if it wasn't for the zero gravity effect, the lack of pressure points. Apollo is bigger than Gemini, and I feel that our quarters are going to be quite adequate.
Are any normal bodily activities like sleep made any more difficult by being in a weightless condition, or is it exactly as it would be under normal G?
Well, on the contrary, when we came back from 7, and I've given a lot of talks about the subject of zero G, the nice thing about zero gravity is the fact that your body is just floating. There are no pressure points, so that therefore sleeping is a lot easier. It's the softest mattress I think you can find. Of course, the first night or two in a new environment, you'll probably have a hard time going to sleep, but after that, it's okay.
Well, what, if any, what if any point of zero G is unpleasant or difficult?
Well, if you promise not to let out our secret, I don't think there is any. It's coming back, really. That's the big problem with spaceflight. The body acclimates itself quite well to zero gravity, and it takes a vacation. The muscles, after a while, I suspect, deteriorate. And the reentry and then the new acclimation of the body to the Earth's gravity is the thing that we have to build up to.
Dr. Barry says that you can have sleeping pills on board for the first time in an American flight. What are your feelings on that?
Well, we had Dexedrine on board our flight, and we thought that before the entry, you know, we might need Dexedrine or something. Is that the stimulant? Was that what we had? One of these pills to make you alert. But we found that by the time of entry, we were like this anyway. We didn't need those pills. I frankly have never taken a sleeping pill. I never plan to take a sleeping pill, and I don't like sleeping pills.
We're going to slip one in his drink.
If we don't sleep well, of course, we may be forced to take them in order to maintain alertness. Of course, we function all right for 14 days, so I don't think there'll be any requirement for them.
Then you are planning pre-flight to take them once you get up there, then?
If required.
If required.
Just if required.
Sure.
Or if told to.
Some people have a history of getting frequent colds, others get them very rarely. I'm wondering what your own histories are in that regard, upper respiratory diseases.
I get two colds a year, one in the fall and one in the spring, and I've already had my fall one. Right? What about you?
I get them from Frank.
Frank never gets a cold from us. He mentioned alluding to his immunity, but that's because he always gives us his.
We all have just recovered from quite heavy colds. I hope this will. We were sick about the same time that the seven crew was sick, and I hope that this is our round for this year.
Slightly after they were sick.
Yeah, slightly after.
Okay, why don't we take a little break here? I think they want a couple of still shots in front of the podium. And we'll pick it up at 11:05 with the two services and the VOA.